than to follow the path along which the Germans have led, they have indeed nothing to offer. To the Germans, all these are merely belated admissions that the liberals have been wrong all the way through, and that they themselves are leading the way to a new and better world, however appalling the period of transition may be. The Germans know that what they still regard as the British and American traditions, and their own new ideals, are fundamentally opposed and irreconcilable views of life. They might be convinced that the way they have chosen was wrong, but nothing will ever convince them that the British or Americans will be better guides on the German path. Least of all will that type of propaganda appeal to those Germans on whose help we must ultimately count in rebuilding Europe, because their values are nearest to our own. For experience has made them wiser and sadder men. They have learned that neither good intentions nor efficiency of organization can preserve decency in a system in which personal freedom and individual responsibility are destroyed. What the German and Italian who have learned the lesson want above all is protection against the monster state, not grandiose schemes for organization on a colossal scale, but opportunity peacefully and in freedom to build up once more their own little worlds. It is not because they believe that to be ordered about by British or Americans is preferable to being ordered about by the Prussians, but because they believe that in a world where democratic ideals have been victorious, they will be less ordered about and left in peace to pursue their own concerns, that we can hope for support from some of the nationals of the enemy countries. If we are to succeed in the war of ideologies and to win over the decent elements in the enemy countries, we must, first of all, regain the belief in the traditional values for which we have stood in the past, and must have the moral courage stoutly to defend the ideals which our enemies attack. Not by shame-faced apologies and by assurances that we are rapidly reforming, not by explaining that we are seeking some compromise between the traditional liberal values and the new totalitarian ideas, shall we win confidence and support. Not the latest improvements we may have effected in our social institutions, which count but little compared with the basic differences of two opposed ways of life, but our unwavering faith in those traditions which have made England and America countries of free and upright, tolerant and independent people, is the thing that counts. Chapter 15. The Prospects of International Order. Of all checks on democracy, federation has been the most efficacious and the most congenial. The federal system limits and restrains the sovereign power by dividing it and by assigning to government only certain defined rights. It is the only method of curbing not only the majority, but the power of the whole people. Lord Acton. In no other field has the world yet paid so dearly for the abandonment of 19th-century liberalism as in the field where the retreat began, in international relations. Yet only a small part of the lesson which experience ought to have taught us has been learned. Perhaps even more than elsewhere, current notions of what is desirable and practicable are here still of a kind which may well produce the opposite of what they promise. The part of the lesson of the recent past which is slowly and gradually being appreciated is that many kinds of economic planning, conducted independently on a national scale, are bound in their aggregate effect to be harmful even from a purely economic point of view and, in addition, to produce serious international friction. That there is little hope of international order or lasting peace so long as every country is free to employ whatever measures it thinks desirable in its own immediate interest, however damaging they may be to others, needs little emphasis now. Many kinds of economic planning are indeed practicable only if the planning authority can effectively shut out all extraneous influences. The result of such planning is, therefore, inevitably, the piling up of restrictions on the movements of men and goods. Less obvious, but by no means less real, are the dangers to peace arising out of the artificially fostered economic solidarity of all the inhabitants of any one country, and from the new blocks of opposed interests created by planning on a national scale. It is neither necessary nor desirable that national boundaries should mark sharp differences in standards of living, that membership of a national group should entitle to a share in a cake altogether different from that in which members of other groups share. If the resources of different nations are treated as exclusive properties of these nations as wholes, if international economic relations, instead of being relations between individuals, become increasingly relations between whole nations organized as trading bodies, they inevitably become the source of friction and envy between whole nations. It is one of the most fatal illusions that, by substituting negotiations between states or organized groups for competition for markets or for raw materials, international friction would be reduced. This would merely put a contest of force in the place of what can only metaphorically be called the struggle of competition, and would transfer to powerful and armed states, subject to no superior law, the rivalries which, between individuals, had to be decided without recourse to force. Economic transactions between national bodies who are at the same time the supreme judges of their own behavior, who bow to no superior law, and whose representatives cannot be bound by any considerations but the immediate interest of their respective nations, must end in clashes of power. On all these, and on the following points, which can be touched upon only very briefly, see Professor Lionel Robbins's Economic Planning and International Order, 1937, Passim. If we were to make no better use of victory than to countenance existing trends in this direction, only too visible before 1939, we might indeed find that we have defeated National Socialism merely to create a world of many National Socialisms, differing in detail, but all equally totalitarian, nationalistic, and in recurrent conflict with each other. The Germans would appear as the disturbers of peace, as they already do to some people, merely because they were the first to take the path along which all the others were ultimately to follow. See particularly the significant book by James Burnham, The Managerial Revolution, 1941. Those who at least partly realize these dangers usually draw the conclusion that economic planning must be done internationally, i.e., by some supranational authority. But though this would avert some of the obvious dangers raised by planning on a national scale, it seems that those who advocate such ambitious schemes have little conception of the even greater difficulties and dangers which their proposals create. The problems raised by a conscious direction of economic affairs on a national scale inevitably assume even greater dimensions when the same is attempted internationally. The conflict between planning and freedom cannot but become more serious as the similarity of standards and values among those submitted to a unitary plan diminishes. There need be little difficulty in planning the economic life of a family, comparatively little in a small community. But as the scale increases, the amount of agreement on the order of ends decreases, and the necessity to rely on force and compulsion grows. In a small community, common views on the relative importance of the main tasks, agreed standards of value, will exist on a great many subjects. But their number will become less and less the wider we throw the net, and, as there is less community of views, the necessity to rely on force and coercion increases. The people of any one country may easily be persuaded to make a sacrifice in order to assist what they regard as their iron industry or their agriculture, or in order that, in their country, nobody should sink below a certain level. So long as it is a question of helping people whose habits of life and ways of thinking are familiar to us, of correcting the distribution of incomes among, or the working conditions of, people we can well imagine, and whose views on their appropriate status are fundamentally similar to ours, we are usually ready to make some sacrifices. But one has only to visualize the problems raised by economic planning of even an area such as Western Europe to see that the moral bases for such an undertaking are completely lacking. Who imagines that there exist any common ideals of distributive justice, such as will make the Norwegian fisherman consent to forego the prospect of economic improvement in order to help his Portuguese fellow, or the Dutch worker to pay more for his bicycle to help the Coventry mechanic, or the French peasant to pay more taxes to assist the industrialization of Italy. If most people are not willing to see the difficulty, this is mainly because, consciously or unconsciously, they assume that it will be they who will settle these questions for the others, and because they are convinced of their own capacity to do this justly and equitably. The English people, for instance, perhaps even more than others, begin to realize what such schemes mean only when it is presented to them that they might be a minority in the planning authority, and that the main lines of the future economic development of Great Britain might be determined by a non-British majority. How many people in England would be prepared to submit to the decision of an international authority, however democratically constituted, which had power to decree that the development of the Spanish iron industry must have precedence over similar development in South Wales, that the optical industry had better be concentrated in Germany to the exclusion of Great Britain, or that only fully refined gasoline should be imported to Great Britain, and all the industries connected with refining reserved for the producer countries? To imagine that the economic life of a vast area comprising many different people can be directed or planned by democratic procedure betrays a complete lack of awareness of the problems such planning would raise. Planning on an international scale, even more than is true on a national scale, cannot be anything but a naked rule of force, an imposition by a small group on all the rest of that sort of standard and employment which the planners think suitable for the rest. If anything is certain, it is that Großraumwirtschaft of the kind at which the Germans have been aiming can be successfully realized only by a master race, a Herrenvolk, ruthlessly imposing its aims and ideas on the rest. It is a mistake to regard the brutality and the disregard of all the wishes and ideals of the smaller people shown by the Germans simply as a sign of their special wickedness. It is the nature of the task they have assumed which makes these things inevitable. To undertake the direction of the economic life of people with widely divergent ideals and values is to assume responsibilities which commit one to the use of force. It is to assume a position where the best intentions cannot prevent one from being forced to act in a way which, to some of those affected, must appear highly immoral. The experience in the colonial sphere, of Great Britain as much as of any other, has amply shown that even the mild forms of planning which Englishmen know as colonial development involve, whether they wish it or not, the imposition of certain values and ideals on those whom they try to assist. It is, indeed, this experience which has made even the most internationally minded of colonial experts so very skeptical of the practicability of an international administration of colonies. This is true even if we assume the dominant power to be as idealistic and unselfish as we can possibly conceive. But how small is the likelihood that it will be unselfish, and how great are the temptations? I believe the standards of decency and fairness, particularly with regard to international affairs, to be as high, if not higher, in England than in any other country. Yet even now we can hear people in England arguing that victory must be used to create conditions in which British industry will be able to utilize to the full the particular equipment which it has built up during the war, that the reconstruction of Europe must be so directed as to fit in with the special requirements of the industries of England, and to secure to everybody in the country the kind of employment for which he thinks himself most fit. The alarming thing about these suggestions is not that they are made, but that they are made in all innocence and regarded as a matter of course by decent people who are completely unaware of the moral enormity which the use of force for such purposes involves. If anyone should still fail to see the difficulties or cherish the belief that, with a little goodwill, they can all be overcome, it will help if he tries to follow the implications of central direction of economic activity applied on a world scale. Can there be much doubt that this would mean a more or less conscious endeavor to secure the dominance of the white man, and would rightly be so regarded by all other races? Until I find a sane person who seriously believes that the European races will voluntarily submit to their standard of life and rate of progress being determined by a world parliament, I cannot regard such plans as anything but absurd. But this does unfortunately not preclude that particular measures, which could be justified only if the principle of world direction were a feasible ideal, are seriously advocated. Perhaps the most powerful agent in creating the belief in the possibility of a single central direction by democratic means of the economic life of many different peoples is the fatal delusion that, if the decisions were left to the people, the community of interest of the working classes would readily overcome the differences which exist between the ruling classes. There is every reason to expect that, with world planning, the clash of economic interests which arises now about the economic policy of any one nation would, in fact, appear in even fiercer form as a clash of interests between whole peoples, which could be decided only by force. On the questions which an international planning authority would have to decide, the interests and opinions of the working classes of the different people will inevitably be as much in conflict, and there will be even less of a commonly accepted basis for an equitable settlement than there is with respect to different classes in any one country. To the worker in a poor country, the demand of his more fortunate colleague to be protected against his low-wage competition by minimum-wage legislation, supposedly in his interest, is frequently no more than a means to deprive him of his only chance to better his conditions by overcoming natural disadvantages by working at wages lower than his fellows in other countries. And to him, the fact that he has to give the product of 10 hours of his labor for the product of 5 hours of the man elsewhere who is better equipped with machinery is as much exploitation as that practiced by any capitalist. It is fairly certain that, in a planned international system, the wealthier and therefore most powerful nations would, to a very much greater degree than in a free economy, become the object of hatred and envy of the poorer ones, and the latter, rightly or wrongly, would all be convinced that their position could be improved much more quickly if they were only free to do what they wished. Indeed, if it comes to be regarded as the duty of the international authority to bring about distributive justice between the different peoples, it is no more than a consistent and inevitable development of socialist doctrine that class strife would become a struggle between the working classes of the different countries. There is at present a great deal of muddle-headed talk about planning to equalize standards of life. It is instructive to consider in a little more detail one of these proposals, to see what precisely it involves. The area for which, at the present moment, our planners are particularly fond of drawing up such schemes is the Danube Basin and southeastern Europe. There can be no doubt about the urgent need for amelioration of economic conditions in this region, from humanitarian and economic considerations, as well as in the interest of the future peace of Europe. Nor that this can be achieved only in a political setting different from that of the past. But this is not the same thing as to wish to see economic life in this region directed according to a single master plan, to foster the development of the different industries according to a schedule laid down beforehand, in a way which makes the success of local initiative dependent on being approved by the central authority and being incorporated in its plan. One cannot, for example, create a kind of Tennessee Valley authority for the Danube Basin without thereby determining beforehand, for many years to come, the relative rate of progress of the different races inhabiting this area, or without subordinating all their individual aspirations and wishes to this task. Planning of this kind must of necessity begin by fixing an order of priorities of the different claims. To plan for the deliberate equalization of standards of living means that the different claims must be ranked according to merit, that some must be given precedence over others, and that the latter must wait their turn, even though those whose interests are thus relegated may be convinced not only of their better right, but also of their ability to reach their goal sooner if they were only given freedom to act on their own devices. There exists no basis which allows us to decide whether the claims of the poor Romanian peasant are more or less urgent than those of the still poorer Albanian, or the needs of the Slovakian mountain shepherd greater than those of his Slovenian colleague. But if the raising of their standards of life is to be effected according to a unitary plan, somebody must deliberately balance the merits of all these claims and decide between them. And once such a plan is put into execution, all the resources of the planned area must serve that plan. There can be no exemption for those who feel they could do better for themselves. Once their claim has been given a lower rank, they will have to work for the prior satisfaction of the needs of those who have been given preference. In such a state of affairs, everybody will rightly feel that he is worse off than he might be if some other plan had been adopted, and that it is the decision and the might of the dominant powers which have condemned him to a place less favorable than he thinks is due to him. To attempt such a thing in a region peopled by small nations, each of which believes equally fervently in its own superiority over the others, is to undertake a task which can be performed only by the use of force. What it would amount to in practice is that the decisions and power of the large nations would have to settle whether the standards of the Macedonian or the Bulgarian peasant should be raised faster, whether the Czech or the Hungarian miner should more rapidly approach Western standards. It does not need much knowledge of human nature, and certainly only a little knowledge of the people of Central Europe, to see that, whatever the decision imposed, there will be many, probably a majority, to whom the particular order chosen will appear supreme injustice, and that their common hatred will soon turn against the power which, however disinterestedly, in fact decides their fate. Though there are no doubt many people who honestly believe that if they were allowed to handle the job, they would be able to settle all those problems justly and impartially, and who would be genuinely surprised to find suspicion and hatred turning against them, they would probably be the first to apply force when those whom they mean to benefit prove recalcitrant, and to show themselves quite ruthless in coercing people in what is presumed to be their own interests. What these dangerous idealists do not see is that where the assumption of a moral responsibility involves that one's moral views should by force be made to prevail over those dominant in other communities, the assumption of such responsibility may place one in a position in which it becomes impossible to act morally. To impose such an impossible moral task on the victorious nations is a certain way morally to corrupt and discredit them. By all means, let us assist the poorer people as much as we can in their own efforts to build up their lives and to raise their standards of living. An international authority can be very just and contribute enormously to economic prosperity if it merely keeps order and creates conditions in which the people can develop their own life. But it is impossible to be just or to let people live their own life if the central authority doles out raw materials and allocates markets, if every spontaneous effort has to be approved, and nothing can be done without the sanction of the central authority. After the discussions in earlier chapters, it is hardly necessary to stress that these difficulties cannot be met by conferring on the various international authorities merely specific economic powers. The belief that this is a practical solution rests on the fallacy that economic planning is merely a technical task, which can be solved in a strictly objective manner by experts, and that the really vital things would still be left in the hands of the political authorities. Any international economic authority, not subject to a superior political power, even if strictly confined to a particular field, could easily exercise the most tyrannical and irresponsible power imaginable. Exclusive control of an essential commodity or service, as, for example, air transport, is, in effect, one of the most far-reaching powers which can be conferred on any authority. And as there is scarcely anything which could not be justified by technical necessities, which no outsider could effectively question, or even by humanitarian and possibly entirely sincere arguments about the needs of some specially ill-favored group which could not be helped in any other way, there is little possibility of controlling that power. The kind of organization of the resources of the world under more or less autonomous bodies, which now so often finds favor in the most surprising quarters, a system of comprehensive monopolies recognized by all the national governments, but subject to none, would inevitably become the worst of all conceivable rackets, even if those entrusted with their administration should prove the most faithful guardians of the particular interests placed in their care. One need only seriously consider the full implications of such apparently innocuous proposals, widely regarded as the essential basis of the future economic order, such as the conscious control and distribution of the supply of essential raw materials, in order to see what appalling political difficulties and moral dangers they create. The controller of the supply of any such raw material as gasoline or timber, rubber or tin, would be the master of the fate of whole industries and countries. In deciding whether to allow the supply to increase and the price or the income of the producers to fall, he would decide whether some country is to be allowed to start some new industry or whether it is to be precluded from doing so. While he protects the standards of life of those he regards as specially entrusted to his care, he will deprive many who are in a much worse position of their best and perhaps only chance to improve it. If all essential raw materials were thus controlled, there would indeed be no new industry, no new venture on which the people of a country could embark without the permission of the controllers, no plan for development or improvement which could not be frustrated by their veto. The same is true of international arrangement for sharing of markets, and even more so of the control of investment and the development of natural resources. It is curious to observe how those who pose as the most hard-boiled realists and who lose no opportunity of casting ridicule on the utopianism of those who believe in the possibility of an international political order, yet regard as more practicable the much more intimate and irresponsible interference with the lives of the different peoples which economic planning involves, and believe that, once hitherto undreamed of power is given to an international government, which has just been represented as not even capable of enforcing a simple rule of law, this greater power will be used in so unselfish and so obviously just a manner as to command general consent. If anything is evident, it should be that, while nations might abide by formal rules on which they have agreed, they will never submit to the direction which international economic planning involves. That while they may agree on the rules of the game, they will never agree on the order of preference in which the rank of their own needs and the rate at which they are allowed to advance is fixed by majority vote. Even if, at first, the peoples should, under some illusion about the meaning of such proposals, agree to transfer such powers to an international authority, they would soon find out that what they have delegated is not merely a technical task, but the most comprehensive power over their very lives. What is evidently at the back of the minds of the not altogether unpracticable realists who advocate these schemes is that, while the great powers will be unwilling to submit to any superior authority, they will be able to use those international authorities to impose their will on the smaller nations within the area in which they exercise hegemony. There is so much realism in this that, by thus camouflaging the planning authorities as international, it might be easier to achieve the condition under which international planning is alone practicable, namely, that it is, in effect, done by one single predominant power. This disguise would, however, not alter the fact that, for all the smaller states, it would mean a much more complete subjection to an external power, to which no real resistance would any longer be possible, than would be involved in the renunciation of a clearly defined part of political sovereignty. It is significant that the most passionate advocates of a centrally directed economic new order for Europe should display, like their Fabian and German prototypes, the most complete disregard of the individuality and of the rights of small nations. The views of Professor Carr, who in this sphere even more than in that of internal policy is representative of the trend toward totalitarianism in England, have already made one of his professional colleagues ask the very pertinent question, if the Nazi way with small sovereign states is indeed to become the common form, what is the war about? Professor C. A. W. Manning, in a review of Professor Carr's Conditions of Peace in the International Affairs Review Supplement, June 1942. Those who have observed how much disquiet and alarm some recent utterances on these questions in papers as different as the London Times and the New Statesman have caused among our smaller allies will have little doubt how much this attitude is even now resented among our closest friends, and how easy it will be to dissipate the stock of goodwill which has been laid up during the war if these advisers are followed. It is significant in more than one respect that, as was once observed in one of the weekly journals, one had already begun to expect a touch of the Carr flavor in the New Statesman pages, as well as in those of The Times. Four Winds, in Time and Tide, February 20, 1943. Those who are so ready to ride roughshod over the rights of small states are, of course, right in one thing. We cannot hope for order or lasting peace after this war, if states, large or small, regain unfettered sovereignty in the economic sphere. But this does not mean that a new superstate must be given powers which we have not learned to use intelligently, even on a national scale, that an international authority ought to be given power to direct individual nations how to use their resources. It means merely that there must be a power which can restrain the different nations from action harmful to their neighbors, a set of rules which defines what a state may do, and an authority capable of enforcing these rules. The powers which such an authority would need are mainly of a negative kind. It must, above all, be able to say no to all sorts of restrictive measures. Far from its being true that, as is now widely believed, we need an international economic authority while the states can at the same time retain their unrestricted political sovereignty, almost exactly the opposite is true. What we need and can hope to achieve is not more power in the hands of irresponsible international economic authorities, but, on the contrary, a superior political power which can hold the economic interests in check, and in the conflict between them can truly hold the scales, because it is itself not mixed up in the economic game. The need is for an international political authority which, without power to direct the different people what they must do, must be able to restrain them from action which will damage others. The powers which must devolve on an international authority are not the new powers assumed by the states in recent times, but that minimum of powers without which it is impossible to preserve peaceful relationships, i.e., essentially, the powers of the ultra-liberal laissez-faire state. And even more than in the national sphere, it is essential that these powers of the international authority should be strictly circumscribed by the rule of law. The need for such a supranational authority becomes indeed greater as the individual states more and more become units of economic administration, the actors rather than merely the supervisors of the economic scene, and as, therefore, any friction is likely to arise not between individuals, but between states as such. The form of international government under which certain strictly defined powers are transferred to an international authority, while in all other respects the individual countries remain responsible for their internal affairs, is, of course, that of federation. We must not allow the numerous ill-considered and often extremely silly claims made on behalf of a federal organization of the whole world during the height of the propaganda for federal union to obscure the fact that the principle of federation is the only form of association of different peoples which will create an international order without putting an undue strain on their legitimate desire for independence. It is a great pity that the flood of Federalist publications which in recent years has descended upon us has deprived the few important and thoughtful works among them of the attention they deserved. One which in particular ought to be carefully consulted when the time comes for the framing of a new political structure of Europe, is Dr. W. Ivor Jennings' small book on A Federation for Western Europe, 1940. Federalism is, of course, nothing but the application to international affairs of democracy, the only method of peaceful change man has yet invented. But it is a democracy with definitely limited powers. Apart from the more impracticable ideal of fusing different countries into a single centralized state, the desirability of which is far from obvious, it is the only way in which the ideal of international law can be made a reality. We must not deceive ourselves that, in the past, in calling the rules of international behavior international law, we were doing more than expressing a pious wish. When we want to prevent people from killing each other, we are not content to issue a declaration that killing is undesirable, but we give an authority power to prevent it. In the same way, there can be no international law without a power to enforce it. The obstacle to the creation of such an international power was very largely the idea that it need command all the practically unlimited powers which the modern state possesses. But with the division of power under the federal system, this is by no means necessary. This division of power would inevitably act at the same time also as a limitation of the power of the whole, as well as of the individual state. Indeed, many of the kinds of planning which are now fashionable would probably become altogether impossible. See on this the author's article on Economic Conditions of Interstate Federation, New Commonwealth Quarterly, Volume 5, September 1939. But it would by no means constitute an obstacle to all planning. It is, in fact, one of the main advantages of federation that it can be so devised as to make most of the harmful planning difficult while leaving the way free for all desirable planning. It prevents, or can be made to prevent, most forms of restrictionism, and it confines international planning to the fields where true agreement can be reached, not only between the interests immediately concerned, but among all those affected. The desirable forms of planning, which can be effected locally and without the need of restrictive measures, are left free and in the hands of those best qualified to undertake it. It is even to be hoped that, within a federation, where there will no longer exist the same reasons for making the individual states as strong as possible, the process of centralization of the past may in some measure be reversed, and some devolution of powers from the state to the local authorities become possible. It is worth recalling that the idea of the world at last finding peace through the absorption of the separate states in large federated groups, and ultimately perhaps in one single federation, far from being new, was indeed the ideal of almost all the liberal thinkers of the 19th century, from Tennyson, whose much-quoted vision of the Battle of the Air is followed by a vision of the federation of the people which will follow their last great fight, right down to the end of the century, the final achievement of a federal organization remained the ever-recurring hope of a next great step in the advance of civilization. 19th-century liberals may not have been fully aware how essential a complement of their principles a federal organization of the different states formed. See on this Professor Robbins's already quoted book, Opposite, pages 240 to 257. But there were few among them who did not express their belief in it as an ultimate goal. As late as the closing years of the 19th century, Henry Sidgwick thought it not beyond the limits of a sober forecast to conjecture that some future integration may take place in the West European states, and if it should take place, it seems probable that the example of America will be followed, and that the new political aggregate will be formed on the basis of a federal polity. The Development of European Polity, published posthumously in 1903, page 439. It was only with the approach of our 20th century that, before the triumphant rise of Realpolitik, these hopes came to be regarded as unpracticable and utopian. We shall not rebuild civilization on the large scale. It is no accident that, on the whole, there was more beauty and decency to be found in the life of the small peoples, and that, among the large ones, there was more happiness and content in proportion as they had avoided the deadly blight of centralization. Least of all shall we preserve democracy or foster its growth if all the power and most of the important decisions rest with an organization far too big for the common man to survey or comprehend. Nowhere has democracy ever worked well without a great measure of local self-government, providing a school of political training for the people at large, as much as for their future leaders. It is only where responsibility can be learned and practiced in affairs with which most people are familiar, where it is the awareness of one's neighbor, rather than some theoretical knowledge of the needs of other people, which guides action, that the ordinary man can take a real part in public affairs, because they concern the world he knows. Where the scope of the political measures becomes so large that the necessary knowledge is almost exclusively possessed by the bureaucracy, the creative impulses of the private person must flag. I believe that here the experience of the small countries like Holland and Switzerland contains much from which, even the most fortunate larger countries, like Great Britain, can learn. We shall all be the gainers if we can create a world fit for small states to live in. But the small can preserve their independence in the international as in the national sphere only within a true system of law which guarantees both that certain rules are invariably enforced and that the authority which has the power to enforce these cannot use it for any other purpose. While for its task of enforcing the common law, the supranational authority must be very powerful, its constitution must at the same time be so designed that it prevents the international, as well as the national authorities, from becoming tyrannical. We shall never prevent the abuse of power if we are not prepared to limit power in a way which occasionally may also prevent its use for desirable purposes. The great opportunity we shall have at the end of this war is that the great victorious powers, by themselves first submitting to a system of rules which they have the power to enforce, may at the same time acquire the moral right to impose the same rules upon others. An international authority which effectively limits the powers of the state over the individual will be one of the best safeguards of peace. The international rule of law must become a safeguard as much against the tyranny of the state over the individual as against the tyranny of the new superstate over the national communities. Neither an omnipotent superstate nor a loose association of free nations, but a community of nations of free men must be our goal. We have long pleaded that it had become impossible to behave in international affairs as we thought it desirable, because others would not play the game. The coming settlement will be the opportunity to show that we have been sincere and that we are prepared to accept the same restrictions on our freedom of action, which in the common interest we think it necessary to impose upon others. Wisely used, the federal principle of organization may indeed prove the best solution of some of the world's most difficult problems. But its application is a task of extreme difficulty, and we are not likely to succeed if, in an overambitious attempt, we strain it beyond its capacity. There will probably exist a strong tendency to make any new international organization all-comprehensive and worldwide. And there will, of course, be an imperative need for some such comprehensive organization, some new League of Nations. The great danger is that, if in the attempt to rely exclusively on this world organization, it is charged with all the tasks which it seems desirable to place in the hands of an international organization, they will not, in fact, be adequately performed. It has always been my conviction that such ambitions were at the root of the weakness of the League of Nations, that in the unsuccessful attempt to make it worldwide, it had to be made weak, and that a smaller and at the same time more powerful league might have been a better instrument to preserve peace. I believe that these considerations still hold, and that a degree of cooperation could be achieved between, say, the British Empire and the nations of Western Europe, and probably the United States, which would not be possible on a world scale. The comparatively close association which a federal union represents will not at first be practicable beyond perhaps even as narrow a region as part of Western Europe, though it may be possible gradually to extend it. It is true that with the formation of such regional federations, the possibility of war between the different blocs still remains, and that to reduce this risk as much as possible, we must rely on a larger and looser association. My point is that the need for some such other organization should not form an obstacle to a closer association of those countries which are more similar in their civilization, outlook, and standards. While we must aim at preventing future wars as much as possible, we must not believe that we can at one stroke create a permanent organization which will make all war in any part of the world entirely impossible. Not only would we be unsuccessful in such an attempt, but we would thereby probably spoil our chances of achieving success in a more limited sphere. As is true with respect to other great evils, the measures by which war might be made altogether impossible for the future may well be worse than even war itself. If we can reduce the risk of friction likely to lead to war, this is probably all we can reasonably hope to achieve. Chapter 16. Conclusion. The purpose of this book has not been to sketch a detailed program of a desirable future order of society. If with regard to international affairs we have gone a little beyond its essentially critical task, it was because in this field we may soon be called upon to create a framework within which future growth may have to proceed for a long time to come. A great deal will depend on how we use the opportunity we shall then have. But whatever we do, it can only be the beginning of a new, long, and arduous process in which we all hope we shall gradually create a world very different from that which we knew during the last quarter of a century. It is at least doubtful whether at this stage a detailed blueprint of a desirable internal order of society would be of much use, or whether anyone is competent to furnish it. The important thing now is that we shall come to agree on certain principles and free ourselves from some of the errors which have governed us in the recent past. However distasteful such an admission may be, we must recognize that we had before this war once again reached a stage where it is more important to clear away the obstacles with which human folly has encumbered our path, and to release the creative energy of individuals, than to devise further machinery for guiding and directing them. To create conditions favorable to progress, rather than to plan progress. The first need is to free ourselves of that worst form of contemporary obscurantism, which tries to persuade us that what we have done in the recent past was all either wise or inevitable. We shall not grow wiser before we learn that much that we have done was very foolish. If we are to build a better world, we must have the courage to make a new start, even if that means some reculer pour mieux sauter. It is not those who believe in inevitable tendencies who show this courage, not those who preach a new order, which is no more than a projection of the tendencies of the last 40 years, and who can think of nothing better than to imitate Hitler. It is, indeed, those who cry loudest for the new order who are most completely under the sway of the ideas which have created this war and most of the evils from which we suffer. The young are right if they have little confidence in the ideas which rule most of their elders, but they are mistaken or misled when they believe that these are still the liberal ideas of the 19th century, which, in fact, the younger generation hardly knows. Though we neither can wish nor possess the power to go back to the reality of the 19th century, we have the opportunity to realize its ideals, and they were not mean. We have little right to feel in this respect superior to our grandfathers, and we should never forget that it is we, the 20th century, and not they, who have made a mess of things. If they had not yet fully learned what was necessary to create the world they wanted, the experience we have since gained ought to have equipped us better for the task. If in the first attempt to create a world of free men we have failed, we must try again. The guiding principle that a policy of freedom for the individual is the only truly progressive policy remains as true today as it was in the 19th century.
Appendix. Related documents. Nazi Socialism. Spring, 1933. Incomprehensible as the recent events in Germany must seem to anyone who has known that country chiefly in the democratic post-war years, any attempt fully to understand these developments must treat them as the culmination of tendencies which date back to a period long before the Great War. Nothing could be more superficial than to consider the forces which dominate the Germany of today as reactionary, in the sense that they want a return to the social and economic order of 1914. The persecution of the Marxists, and of Democrats in general, tends to obscure the fundamental fact that National Socialism is a genuine socialist movement, whose leading ideas are the final fruit of the anti-liberal tendencies which have been steadily gaining ground in Germany since the later part of the Bismarckian era, and which led the majority of the German intelligentsia first to socialism of the chair, and later to Marxism in its social democratic or communist form. One of the main reasons why the socialist character of National Socialism has been quite generally unrecognized is, no doubt, its alliance with the nationalist groups, which represent the great industries and the great landowners. But this merely proves that these groups, too, as they have since learnt to their bitter disappointment, have at least partly been mistaken as to the nature of the movement. But only partly because, and this is the most characteristic feature of modern Germany, many capitalists are themselves strongly influenced by socialistic ideas and have not sufficient belief in capitalism to defend it with a clear conscience. But in spite of this, the German entrepreneur class have manifested almost incredible short-sightedness in allying themselves with a movement of whose strong anti-capitalistic tendencies there should never have been any doubt. A careful observer must always have been aware that the opposition of the Nazis to the established socialist parties, which gained them the sympathy of the entrepreneur, was only to a very small extent directed against their economic policy. What the Nazis mainly objected to was their internationalism and all the aspects of their cultural program, which were still influenced by liberal ideas. But the accusations against the Social Democrats and the Communists, which were most effective in their propaganda, were not so much directed against their program as against their supposed practice, their corruption and nepotism, and even their alleged alliance with the Golden International of Jewish capitalism. It would indeed hardly have been possible for the nationalists to advance fundamental objections to the economic policy of the other socialist parties when their own published program differed from these only in that its socialism was much cruder and less rational. The famous 25 points drawn up by Herr Feder, one of Hitler's early allies, repeatedly endorsed by Hitler and recognized by the bylaws of the National Socialist Party as the immutable basis of all its actions, which together with an extensive commentary is circulating throughout Germany in many hundreds of thousands of copies, is full of ideas resembling those of the early socialists. But the dominant feature is a fierce hatred of anything capitalistic, individualistic profit-seeking, large-scale enterprise, banks, joint stock companies, department stores, international finance and loan capital, the system of interest slavery in general. The abolition of these is described as the indecipherable of the program, around which everything else turns. It was to this program that the masses of the German people, who were already completely under the influence of collectivist ideas, responded so enthusiastically. That this violent anti-capitalistic attack is genuine, and not a mere piece of propaganda, becomes as clear from the personal history of the intellectual leaders of the movement as from the general milieu from which it springs. It is not even denied that many of the young men who today play a prominent part in it have previously been communists or socialists, and to any observer of the literary tendencies which made the German intelligentsia ready to join the ranks of the new party, it must be clear that the common characteristic of all the politically influential writers, in many cases free from definite party affiliations, was their anti-liberal and anti-capitalist trend. Groups like that formed around the review Die Tat have made the phrase the end of capitalism an accepted dogma to most young Germans. That the movement is more anti-liberal than anything else is closely connected with another important aspect of it, the anti-rational, mystical, and romantic sentiment which has been growing for years among the youth of Germany. The protest against liberal intellectualism, which was recently so strongly voiced by the students of the University of Berlin, was not an isolated aberration, but a true expression of the feeling of great masses of the people. It would be too long a story to go into all the different intellectual sources of these anti-rational tendencies in art and literature, which have all converged, often to the amazement and consternation of their originators, in the Nazi movement. But it must be said that here again the main influence which destroyed the belief in the universality and unity of human reason was Marx's teaching of the class-conditioned nature of our thinking, of the difference between bourgeois and proletarian logic, which needed only to be applied to other social groups such as nations or races, to supply the weapon now used against rationalism as such. How completely this Marxian idea has permeated German thought can be seen from the fact that, during the past few years, it has actually been promoted as sociology of knowledge to the rank of a new branch of learning. It is obvious that from this intellectual relativism, which denied the existence of truths which could be recognized independently of race, nation, or class, there was only a step to the position which puts sentiment above rational thinking. That anti-liberalism and anti-rationalism are so intimately bound up with one another is easy to understand, and is, in fact, inevitable. If rule by force, by some privileged group, is to be justified, its superiority has to be accepted, for it cannot be proved. But what is less easily understood, though of immense importance, is the fact illustrated by German and Russian developments that the anti-liberalism which, when confined to the economic field, today has the sympathy of almost all the rest of the world, leads inevitably to a reign of universal compulsion, to intolerance and the suppression of intellectual freedom. The inherent logic of collectivism makes it impossible to confine it to a limited sphere. Beyond certain limits, collective action in the interest of all can only be made possible if all can be coerced into accepting as their common interest what those in power take it to be. At that point, coercion must extend to the individual's ultimate aims and ideas, and must attempt to bring everyone's Weltanschauung into line with the ideas of the rulers. The collectivist and anti-individualist character of German National Socialism is not much modified by the fact that it is not a proletarian but a middle-class socialism, and that it is, in consequence, inclined to favor the small artisan and shopkeeper, and to set the limit up to which it recognizes private property somewhat higher than does communism. In the first instance, it will probably nominally recognize private property in general. But private initiative will probably be hedged about with restrictions on competition, so that little freedom will remain. Artisans, shopkeepers, and professional men will, in all likelihood, be organized in guilds, like those of the medieval crafts, which will regulate their activities. In the case of the wealthier capitalists, state control and restriction of income will leave little more than the name of property, even while the intention of correcting the undue accumulation of wealth in the hands of individuals has not yet been carried out. Even at the present moment, state commissioners have been put in charge of many important industries, and, if the more radical wing of the party has its way, the same is likely to happen in many other cases. At the present time, when the National Socialist Party has grown to such an enormous size, and accordingly embraces elements with very divergent views, it is, of course, difficult to say which view will predominate. But if, as seems increasingly probable, the more radical views on economic policy hold the field, it will mean that the scare of Russian communism has driven the German people unawares into something which differs from communism in little but name. Indeed, it is more than probable that the real meaning of the German Revolution is that the long-dreaded expansion of communism into the heart of Europe has taken place, but is not recognized because the fundamental similarity of methods and ideas is hidden by the difference in the phraseology and the privileged groups. For the present, the German people have reacted against the treatment received from the community of democratic and capitalistic countries by leaving that community. Nothing, however, would be less justifiable than that the nations of Western Europe should look down on the German people because they have fallen victims to which, in this country, seems a kind of barbarism. What must be realized is that this is only the ultimate and necessary outcome of a process of development in which the other nations have been for a long time steadily following Germany, albeit at a considerable distance. The gradual extension of the field of state activity, the increase in restrictions on international movements of both men and goods, sympathy with central economic planning, and the widespread playing with dictatorship ideas all tend in this direction. In Germany, where these things had gone furthest, an intellectual reaction, which will now hardly survive, had been definitely underway. The fact that the character of the present movement is so generally misjudged makes it seem likely that the reaction in other countries will speed up rather than weaken the operation of these tendencies which lead in the direction in which Germany is now going. So far, there seems little prospect that the reversal of these intellectual tendencies elsewhere will come in time to prevent other countries from following Germany in this last step also. Reader's Report by Frank Knight. December 10, 1943. To General Editor and Committee on Publication, University of Chicago Press. From Frank H. Knight. The Road to Serfdom by F. A. Hayek is a masterly performance of the job it undertakes. That job is to show by general and historical reasoning, the latter primarily with